My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. We hope you'll stay tuned. And we are joined in studio. I am very, very pleased to have Father Loren Reby with us. Father Reby, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the opportunity to come in this afternoon and to share a little bit with you folks.
Well, let's see what we can do, because I want to make sure I have you on mic right, and it looks like we have this one going, and perhaps it's not me. And we'll try and see what we've got happening here. Anyway, you have been down in Guatemala, Central America, and Mexico. I would like to, perhaps, if we could, start with your involvement in Mexico. Somebody was telling me that you were one of the priests who was actually thrown out of Mexico by the Mexican government. Is that correct?
That's correct. In 1995, June, I was arrested in my parish in Chiapas after having served for 21 years as a priest in that part of the world, and jailed by Mexican judicial police and expelled from the country. There are now 8 foreign priests who have been arrested and expelled from Chiapas since 1995.
Talk, if you will. I mean, certainly a lot of people, I think, and as our previous guest was talking about, in part because of the internet, are informed about what's happening in Chiapas and what's happening with the Zapatista movement down there. You have actually been in Chiapas and have been at the point of the Mexican government's resentment to what's happening there. Talk, if you will, about what's actually happening from somebody who's really been on the ground in Chiapas.
Well, what any of us are trying to do is let the people themselves in Chiapas tell their story. When I first went to Chiapas, I'm originally from the Los Angeles area, Boyle Heights in East L.A. I was ordained a Catholic diocesan priest in Los Angeles in 1970. Had a great assignment at the beach in Santa Monica to start off with. And after 4 years there, it was a time in our church when the Holy Father was asking the wealthier North American church to share with Latin America. And I took up the call and was given permission to do missionary work in Chiapas, down on the border with Guatemala. And the first thing I met was our bishop down there, Bishop Samuel Ruiz Garcia, who is a prophet. He saw us coming, the great white American savior complex at work, with food and clothing and medical supplies. And his response was, he sent me out to a jungle indigenous village and left me there. For me, it was about 3 months, just long enough for me to wonder if I had ever met the bishop. Once in a while, I would see a piece of plastic, a bowl or a dish, just to remind myself of what century I was living in. These people have lived this way, Mayan indigenous people, for the past thousands of years. There are over 1 million of them in the highlands. After I was there for 3 months, Bishop Ruiz called me in and asked me if I still wanted to be a missionary in Chiapas, because this was going to be my seminary. I was going to learn about God from these people and about who I am from these people. I stayed on, and it turned out to be a very privileged 21 years of my life working with the Mayans in the highlands of Chiapas.
We're talking with Father Loren Reby, and we are talking about Chiapas, and we'll also be talking about Guatemala, because Father Loren Reby has also been involved in Guatemala as well. Father Reby, I want to just maybe sidetrack to something, because a couple of years ago I was privileged to go down to El Salvador and Guatemala, mm-hmm. in part with a group of people who were attempting to do some fact-finding around the Army School of the Americas, right. Father Roy Bourgeois' mm-hmm. group. And one of the things that I noticed is that for the most part, for me, being here in the United States, in my opinion, unfortunately, most of the quote-unquote religious people that I was hearing about and coming in contact with were these really sort of kind of judgmental, yelling, screaming types. And then I went...
A little bit of guilt thrown in, maybe,
for the heck of it? Well, not just so much the guilt, but the moralizing and the judgment and the condemning. And then I was very, very privileged to be with a group of religious people who seem to be, in my opinion, doing what Christ actually taught, which was actually like trying to help people and all of that. There just seems to be, in many cases a different philosophy about what Christianity and what religion is when you compare these two groups of people. I mean, does that make sense to you?
Oh, sure. And this was the beauty of the way our bishop invited all of us to be church and be people, to listen, not having something to share with them, first of all, but appreciating that the very poor people, like the Mayan Indians, are the ones who are in touch with God. They're the ones who can teach us. And to listen. Very hard for me to go through that process. To respect them enough, first of all, to believe that they were the ones in touch, and through them I would learn about life. Once I could do that, beautiful, beautiful things began to happen. Because at the same time, they would talk about their pain. They're talking about life in Chiapas. Chiapas still lives a feudal system. 18 very wealthy families control the entire state as if it were their own ranch. They take turns being governor. They own all the good land. They control the police force, the judges, the commerce. You almost have to see this stuff to believe it. And everybody works for them. The indigenous people work on the coffee plantations in Chiapas. They start out about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and work till 3 or 4 in the afternoon. They're making a daily wage now of about 20 Mexican pesos. The exchange rate is, what, about 10 pesos to one American dollar. We're talking $2 a day in wages. And trying to live on that. Their basic diet, black beans and corn tortillas. Beans right now in Chiapas are 13 pesos a kilo. To buy 2 pounds of beans for the family is better than half of what a man makes working all day in the fields. The fiesta food was always chicken soup. You'd go out to the mountain villages, and there'd be a baptism or a wedding. They would kill the chickens and make soup for the whole world. Right now, a chicken in Chiapas is 40 Mexican pesos, 2 days' wages, to put meat on the table for his family. With that kind, you can imagine the amount of suffering that goes on in their lives. Life expectancy, by the way, is still between 40 and 45 years of age with our people. Nobody knows their grandparents among the indigenous in the highlands. Infant mortality, about 50% still. 85% of the people infected with tuberculosis. And on and on and on with this type of exploitation that's going on in their area.
And the Mexican government now in particular, and because I'd like to start with that, because eventually we're going to go to the whole topic of NAFTA and globalization, which has even impacted life in Chiapas more, as I understand it. We know why, but why isn't the Mexican government doing something to help these people?
Well, it seems to me that the Mexican government, certainly in Chiapas, are these 19 families. It's two ways to spell the same thing. Allied right now, since the uprising, with the federal government and the Mexican military, all of which are very important factors in life in Mexico, and they don't always run in Mexico like we believe them to run in our own country, with the civilian government in control of the military. We saw that during the uprising, when a group of indigenous took up arms on January 1st of 1994 to commemorate the signing of the Free Trade Agreement between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. The response of the Mexican government was not to try and find the causes of the uprising, which is this poverty, this feudalism, a corrupt system, the injustice that goes on in Chiapas. Their response was to send in the Mexican army. Initially, 25,000 troops, well-armed troops, all brand new U.S. issue, were sent into Chiapas. Right now, they tell us between 50 and 70,000 well-armed troops in Chiapas, in the highlands. The neighboring parish to Miocosingo has traditionally had one medical doctor for every 25,000 Indians. Right now, they have one. For every one Indian, they have 5 armed Mexican soldiers. And the people wonder what the Mexican government is spending to maintain an army that size, and how that money could be used in terms of helping the people through empowerment in their own lives, health, education, and political or democratic reform for Chiapas, which is what the Zapatistas are asking for. So they're all aligned in keeping a status quo. There are over 10 million indigenous people in Mexico, and I guess one of the fears maybe of the central government is these different indigenous groups throughout the country aligning with one another because they're the poorest of the poor in Mexico.
This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. We're talking with Father Loren Reby, who is joining us here in studio. Father Reby, you bring up an interesting point, is that many people have heard about the insurgency, if you will, of the Zapatistas. There are also other groups, as I understand it, or at least have been some other uprisings in other areas of Mexico, whether, you know, certainly haven't gotten as and been as successful, if you will, as what's happened in Chiapas in gaining attention. But there are other rebel
groups. I understand there are about four or five rebel groups who, from my understanding now, follow more the pattern we've been used to in Latin America as maybe socialist-oriented groups. Interested in defending the rights of the poor and making changes towards socialism in the country, taking over power. And I think that's, for many of us, the attractiveness about the Zapatista movement. After the initial days of violence, they have backed away from violence as a solution, and they call the violence in the initial days as a way to call the world's attention. I remember just after the uprising, one of the elderly indigenous ladies in my parish came in crying into the rectory one morning, accusing me of having lied to her people. I've been accused of a lot of things over the years, but so I asked her what she was talking about. And she said, "You and the church have always told us that it was wrong to kill." And I said, "Well, that's not just me and the church. This happens to be, you know, our scriptural basis for right. what we believe." And she said, "And we believe that. And the Zapatistas took up arms. There was violence for 2 days. And the entire world now knows about our struggle. Whereas for years and years, nobody was interested." And so the attention that had been brought by the Zapatista uprising, I think, surprised them, too. And brought them more into line of having the patience of the indigenous people, looking for a democratic and a dialogue solution to the problems in Chiapas. And not just Chiapas. This has been the stickler, I think, for the Mexican government. They call for democratic reform for the entire Mexican Republic.
You bring up a very interesting topic, and that is, on the one hand, of course, we have the teachings of the church, which really talk in terms of nonviolence and turning the other cheek and all of that. Yet at the same time, in many cases, what we see is we see, as you so stated, until a people are willing to get out, fight, bleed, and die to try and make a change, the same oligarchical oppressive system, you know, just continues to stay in place. It's you know, I mean, how is a priest, how do you reconcile that?
That's just history. And we don't work in that area.
Right.
After the uprising, of course, immediately after, the Mexican government, being a good racist organization, refused to believe that the indigenous themselves were capable of even having their own uprising. They wanted to blame it on drug traffickers. They blamed it on Cubans, Guatemalans. Finally settled on blaming it on the Catholic Church. They accused Marcos, as you recall, of being a Catholic priest.
Right.
It couldn't be Indians doing it. So it had to be somebody else. And with that kind of an attitude, the people felt that they needed to break out of that mold. They declared this as a war of self-defense against the 500 years of institutional violence that has been killing their children.
We're talking with Father Loren Reby. Father Reby, you bring up another interesting topic just now, and that is the topic of racism. And many people in the United States, race is the big question in the United States that our country refuses to deal with. We don't think of racism in terms of Mexico or Latin America, but nevertheless, there is quite a bit.
Yeah, definitely. And it's certainly based on economics. That's probably the source of all of our problems in a certain sense. Maybe the source of some of our solutions, I don't know. But certainly in Chiapas, the indigenous people are considered to be subhuman. They still are expected to step off a sidewalk if Latinos or Mestizos or the boss people walk down the street, they still kiss the patron's hand when they meet them and are very, very obliging and subservient to the lighter-complected people and the wealthier people in Mexico. And that's produced kind of a psychology among them. The indigenous people are often difficult to work with because since they were children, they were taught, maybe as a protective mechanism by their own parents, that indigenous people, Indians, are worth nothing and will never be worth anything, and just to settle for their lot in life.
We're talking with Father Loren Reby, who is joining us in studio. We're talking about Chiapas, of where he has been a parish priest for, was it 12 years, is it?
21 years.
21 years. I'm sorry, I transposed the numbers. Father Reby, let me ask you, because we are going to talk about Guatemala as well, and one of the ties, of course, between Chiapas and Guatemala, I believe, is the involvement of the U.S. military in all of this, in particular the Army School of the Americas. As I understand it, Mexico is now sending more soldiers to the SOA than any other country in the world. I mean, does that make sense to you?
Well, the reports I get are close to 300 officers presently being trained in Fort Benning, Georgia, in counter-insurgency activities. It's not to defend, of course, the Mexican border against outside invaders. It's to defend the Mexican status quo government political system against their own people, and most often it's against the poorest of their own people. And this is where we got into trouble, I think, as a church, happily, in Chiapas. The government has accused the Catholic Church of inciting the indigenous people to take up arms. That accusation is false. But as you know, poor people don't tend to resist. Poor people take on this psychology of acceptance, of passivity. And where the church, I believe, was instrumental and is instrumental over 35 years with our bishop, was offering them the scriptural texts. You open the first page of the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures, talks about being made in the image and likeness of a creator. It talks about human dignity. We were also able to use two of the Mayan scriptures that are still available, that were not destroyed. And they talk about that beautiful world where man and woman are supposed to live in peace and dignity. Along with that awareness over the years through scripture, the Old Testament prophets, the New Testament prophets, of course, new commandments of love, brotherhood, sisterhood. That made a difference, I believe, in the people's lack of acceptance as poverty as a gift from God, and began to see poverty as something to be struggled against, to take on the scripture challenge of building up, in religious terms, what is called a kingdom of justice, peace, and love. And as that began to happen, the people were organizing on their own in political groups, economic cooperatives, coffee exporting groups, and there was a tremendous amount of repression. I saw this continually. They were not allowed politically to change the system, and I think that led then to the pressure to take up arms on the part of the Zapatista groups. It's important too to remember that the vast majority of indigenous groups in Chiapas have not taken up arms. I believe they are committed to social change, but they believe, because of their faith basis in the power of prayer — these are tremendously faith-filled people, it's refreshing — they believe in the power of democratic organization, and they're doing that, and they believe in the power of education, and they're also making attempts toward education for their young people, to make these changes in Chiapas for the better, and to do it without violence. That's the aspect that I believe our diocese and our church has been supporting.
We're talking with Father Loren Reby about Chiapas, and we'll be moving to Guatemala. Father Reby, of course, is extremely knowledgeable about these areas of the world. Father Reby, I mean, certainly it seems that the ruling oligarchy in almost any country, be it Mexico or any country in Central or Latin America, seems to want to blame the church for people resisting their oppression. I mean, I'm thinking about what happened with the Jesuits in El Salvador, right, where Roberto de Bassan had, I believe, the Alacat Battalion go over and murder them, thinking that if he murdered the Jesuits, that somehow or another that would stop the revolution.
Yeah, the folks don't read history. The people in power, if they read a little history, persecuting the church is one of the sure signs, really, that you're going to lose out, because this kind of repression against faith-filled people just encourages them to understand better their calling as Christians and as good people all over to change a system that allows for this kind of death and persecution.
I know that you have just recently returned from Guatemala. Can we talk about what is happening there? Because, of course, Guatemala is at the end, supposedly, of a 36-year-old civil war, if we want to call it that. But yet the violence continues with the murder of Bishop Girardi, and revelations of U.S. involvement are really coming forward. Even our own president, William Clinton, has, quote-unquote, apologized for the U.S. role in Guatemala. Can you talk about what's happening in Guatemala?
Well, my phase right now in Guatemala is one of learning and listening. I am only there, just came back from 6 months, wonderful 6 months, on the outskirts of Guatemala City in a parish, nobody knows how many folks, of displaced people from different parts of the country. And I'm only in Guatemala because I was expelled from Chiapas, where I would rather be. I am still, technically, by church policy, the pastor of the parish that I have been pastor of for 20-some years in Chiapas. And with the persecution of the church and the expulsion of the priests, I was asked by the bishop to continue to help our education program in Chiapas, which I've done for the past 4 years since the expulsion, with awareness raising and fundraisings in my own country here in the United States. Sacramento has been wonderful receptions in about 8 or 9 different parishes now in Sacramento. But I really felt the need to get back to Latin America, to center myself again. These people have become for me a way of finding my own spirituality. And so a religious sister that I worked with in Chiapas is now working in this parish in Guatemala. So I signed on for these past 6 months with them. It was a wonderful experience. And as you say, listening, the peace agreements were signed after 37 years of violence, over 140,000 people killed, mostly indigenous people, mostly victims, if you believe the church's Guatemala Nunca Más investigations over the past several years. 87% of the massacres and killings were done by the military against the indigenous people. I was at the anniversary mass of Bishop Girardi in the town square, the center park of Guatemala, in April. Over 150,000 poor people marched into the capital city for that liturgy. It was quite impressive, because everybody risks when you do that in Guatemala. I think the killing of the bishop was a sign, and everybody in Guatemala seems to believe that, that the military are still very much in control, and they don't want any of us to forget that they can do and undo on any level of society, any time, any place they want to in Guatemala. It's kind of a frightening experience in that sense. And yet the response of the people is again, that simplicity, that faith, but that determination to make the place better.
It's important, I think, to note that, as I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Bishop Girardi was murdered 2 or 3 days
same
after.
Day.
The same, was it the same day?
Same Sunday evening. He gave the report on the Historical Memory Commission, the Guatemalan Human Rights Department of the Archdiocese, came together and did this report on the victims' names, places, times, and that report was published Sunday morning at the cathedral. That evening he was bludgeoned to death, the bishop.
We're talking with Father Loren Reby about now Guatemala after having discussed the situation in Chiapas. Caller, you're live on the air.
Although I agree with you that your efforts are like trying to fill a bucket with a hole in it, because the people here in the United States, they're not opposed to having the nation, the greatest corporations in this country as well as other countries, to go down there and imperialize and impose their will and prostitute the people in Mexico and the other countries, because it produces profit. And in fact, many of our ordinary common people like to go down to Mexico and get beautiful handmade artifacts and bring it up here and sell it to flea markets at tremendous profits. And so it's a thing where whatever goes on there, it has the unexpressed approval of the common ordinary people. We don't care if, you know, and if we express
Let me ask you a question. Do you care?
Do I care?
Yeah.
Of course I care.
Well, I've spoken about this many times. Well, then what makes you think other people don't care?
Because in the case of South Africa, before it became civilized, we had tremendous cooperation, mass demonstrations by white people and black people and all kinds of people on the streets, pressure on the Congress and the president, do something about it, so we imposed sanctions. Do you think that we could get sanctions imposed on Mexico and the other countries by the Congress and the president? The president has improved. What is NAFTA except legalized slavery?
Let me go ahead and ask Father Reby about that, because I think the caller does bring up a very good point in the fact that certainly many Americans, Europeans, many people of the so-called industrialized world do profit one way or another, or benefit from the oppression of people in Mexico and or other areas of Latin America. How do we motivate them to care?
Well, that seems to be the story of capitalism, certainly, and dependent capitalism in third world countries. You know, I've been in more states in the United States in these past 4 years than I ever was growing up in this country. And it's been a negative experience in one sense, but a very positive experience. The number of activist groups, and I've been working with people like Global Exchange out of San Francisco and Pastors for Peace from New York, and I would say practically nonstop in 4 years, from city to city, place to place, events, caravans for Central America and for Chiapas. And I am very favorably impressed of the number of Americans who are extremely concerned and letting their concern guide them into action, whether it is the protest against the School of the Americas, whether it's the 50 Years is Enough campaign about the world debt, one thing after another. Congress people, I've had the opportunity to talk to Congress people who are concerned, friends of Mexico, but can see where this is going. I don't know how to tell in terms of numbers, but the movement is certainly happening. A lot of the groups who were more concerned about Central America initially have become concerned about Mexico, and here in Sacramento, many groups are doing plenty about it.
Well, one of the things, and perhaps maybe one of the things that could really be done to help muster some concern, perhaps on the part of people who traditionally might not be concerned about, quote-unquote, the plight of the poor in Mexico, is that for those people who are listening who are really, really concerned about immigration here in California, if you think you're concerned about immigration now, you wait until four or five full-fledged wars break out in Mexico, and you'll have people swarming the borders like nobody's business. And perhaps maybe the thing to do now might be to put some pressure on your Congress people to advocate for some justice for the poor people there, simply, if for no other reason, to do so in your own best interest, if you believe that a massive migration of refugees coming into California and or Texas might be something that you wouldn't particularly see as being beneficial to the U.S. I mean, if we want to put it in those kinds of terms, if you can't be concerned about what I think any decent human being should be concerned about is what's being done to people. I mean, let's face facts. I mean, the same thing is happening to people here in the United States too, maybe not to the same degree. But certainly there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about what's happening in Latin America.
There are, and there are a lot of people who are concerned. And the important thing is to get the information. I've noticed it's a little difficult out of the regular U.S. newspapers and the television news to find out what's happening in Mexico. But over the Internet and different human rights groups are certainly getting the information out. The Zapatistas themselves, our diocese in Chiapas is publishing constantly and inviting people to make phone calls, to get on lists, to help individuals who have been treated unjustly in Chiapas, and to put their names and their vote where it can make a difference. People want to stay, certainly the indigenous people, they want to stay home. They don't want to go anywhere else. But they have to make a dignified living at home. And for our people, that means having a plot of land to be able to grow enough corn and beans to survive. They're indigenous people. They really do not want to be part of our society in one sense. They certainly do not want an economic accumulation of any shape or form. They're a collective people, a community people. And I think can be appreciated for that, and there should be room on in this world for these kind of people, I hope.
This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. We're talking with Father Loren Reby about Chiapas and about Guatemala. Father Reby, I'd like to just briefly, if we can, go back to Guatemala for just a second, because I think one of the things that perhaps many people don't understand here when we're talking about the level of carnage that has happened there, I know that they have thousands, if perhaps not, you know, tens of thousands of what they refer to as cementerios clandestinos, clandestine cemeteries where, you know, any number of people from, you know, tens to hundreds to more were murdered by the military and then just buried in mass graves all over the country, correct?
That's correct. And this Remy, a church human rights program, became involved in that. As I say, most of the victims are indigenous. And for indigenous people, they have some very strong beliefs about life and life after death. And one of the things they have asked the church is to find the remains of the victims and to try to identify those. So there has been a magnificent project in Guatemala to find the clandestine cemeteries, to exhume the remains, to try and identify those, help from all over the world with forensics, so that these remains can be returned to their people so that their spirits and their ancestors can rest in peace. And that it hasn't been to try and blame anyone. The indigenous people are not vindictive. They want justice, but they don't want to blame any particular people for what have happened. They want to make sure it doesn't happen again and that their loved ones are at peace.
When I was in Guatemala, we went to the office where they were trying to conduct some of the forensic research to help bring the remains back to their loved ones. But one of the things that you just brought up, the whole issue of justice, as I understand it, the treaty, if you will, actually has a clause in there that really prevents the perpetrators or what would perhaps be referred to as the intellectual authors of these crimes to be brought to justice. And I know that there are people who are very unhappy about that.
Right. On the 16th of May, was a very difficult day. It was a votation, an elections type of thing, a popular vote in Guatemala for changing the Guatemalan constitution to bring that constitution into line with the peace agreement that was signed in December of 97. There was 85% absenteeism on that day, and the no votes won. The ones who said not change the constitution, mainly in the city of Guatemala and the city of Quetzaltenango, where there again is a larger mestizo or mixed blood population and a fear of the indigenous people, and giving them any kind of rights is going to change the way of life of the privileged few. It was disappointing in that sense. But I think what the analyst said, it showed that the indigenous people are moving ahead. They are organizing. But they do not understand an organization of a government on the level of a constitution. It was proposed to them in a very, very complicated way, I think for obvious reasons, and they did not know how to respond on that level yet. So there's still a lot of work to be done within their own organizations.
We're speaking with Father Loren Reby. Father Reby, we just have a few minutes left, and I guess we need to get to kind of a local priest makes good here, huh? You have ties in our area.
I've got some wonderful family here in the Grass Valley and Auburn area. My cousins, Aunt Skip, Uncle Dell, who passed away last year, Reby's Auto Parts. So I come up when I can. Always good to see them and spend some time with the Reby's up here in the Grass Valley area.
Father Reby, let me ask you, because what I'd like to try and get to is to talk, if we can, about some solutions, and what can people who are listening now, what can they do to be supportive of the situation in Chiapas and or Guatemala? I mean, you know, our caller talked about people not caring or whatever.
Right.
I think there are people who don't care. I think there are also a lot of people who are misinformed. What can people in our listening audience do to really try and help bring a just resolution to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think you mentioned it, Mike, when you said that we're all tied into this together, certainly the U.S. and Mexico, to be aware and concerned about what is happening in that country, because there are some beautiful initiatives of democratic reform in Mexico that need some support. Mexicans have to solve their own problems, and so do the indigenous people. But they can be supported in that from people from the outside. With all my years there and since the expulsion, I have done, I think, what I can on a political level. I put out a lawsuit against the government of Mexico with the Organization of American States, got a favorable response November of last year from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And this is, again, not to get me back as much as to keep those who are there safe, to let the Mexican government know that the world, in a certain sense, is watching. Another thing that was very important to me was an education program that our parish was able to start down in Chiapas, and there are several supporters of that group here in the Sacramento area. We have over 200 young indigenous men and women going to junior high and high school now at government schools, but living in board and room facilities where they're able to continue respecting their own culture and looking toward education as a way of gaining the opportunity to better serve their own people. We also have 54 young indigenous men and women going to colleges in different parts of Mexico. When I was in Guatemala, since I have not been able to go back to Chiapas, last week had a meeting with 20 indigenous from Chiapas. They met me just across the border in Guatemala. A very interesting way to run a parish, by the way. A magnificent week to see these folks again and to spend some time with them. They're family to me. And they mentioned that they needed 22 more scholarships to send young high school graduates to colleges in Mexico. It takes me about $25 a month to keep a kid in high school and about $100 American dollars a month to keep each kid in college. And there's been great response in the Sacramento area.
Are there any contact numbers that you could give out locally for people who perhaps would like to contribute time, money, or energy to this
right,
type of project?
Right, and become more informed about
Absolutely.
What is happening in that part. A group that has been very supportive is called MADEP, Mayan Artisan and Development Education Project in Sacramento. I can give you their number.
Please do.
Area code 916-455-1796.
And can you give that number one more time for people who are looking for pens and pencils right at this moment?
Wonderful. MADEP is the name of the organization, Mayan Arts Development and Education Project. Area code 916-455-1796.
Father Loren Reby, thank you for being with us today on the program to talk about Chiapas and Guatemala. And let me say, sir, I can't think of anyone who could be a more articulate and a compassionate speaker on behalf of the people that you've been serving in your parish for 21 years. Thank you very much
for
being with us.
Thank you, Mike, for the opportunity to share about these folks.
I appreciate it. That's it for this edition of the program. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. If you're interested in copies of this or other Full Logic Reverse programs, you can contact us via email at flr@jps.net or by telephone at area code 530-265-9462. Full Logic Reverse is produced at FLR Studios in Nevada City, California, USA. Our music is by Rick Payne. We hope you'll join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.